Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Stephen Macedo. He's the Lawrence Rockefeller Professor of Politics at Princeton University and the author of a recent book titled Just Married, Same-Sex Couples, Monogamy, and the Future of Marriage. Steve, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Grant. Nice to be with you.
I want to start by asking you a question that's similar to one I asked on a recent program with some other researchers who are looking at the public's views regarding LGBT rights and how they might those views might be influenced. And it concerns the recent historical context for marriage equality. The fact that views toward LGBT rights, but particularly lesbian and gay rights, have changed dramatically. And they've changed dramatically quickly compared with past civil rights efforts. And I was curious to know, why do you think that's been the case in this instance?
Yeah, no, it's really quite astonishing. My colleagues who do empirical work say there's never been any important social issue on which public opinion has shifted so quickly and so steadily. I think a big part of it was obviously people coming out. That was partly forced by the AIDS epidemic, but also the activism and greater tolerance that came along eventually. After that, television media also made a difference. Will and Grace, I think, had a significant effect, and that also encouraged people to come out. And, you know, I think the number of people that knew someone, had a family member, and got to know them and respect them. The other thing that happened along with that is the public shifted its view from thinking of being gay or lesbian as a lifestyle choice to realizing it's an orientation for most people, something that people experience as a given. That's not necessary for tolerance or equal rights, but I think it's important and significant. And so I think a whole bunch of things came together. The one other thing that I think is important is that we had a kind of sustained national conversation about the arguments, starting in a way with a Hawaii decision where briefly the Hawaii Supreme Court entertained the idea of marriage rights for same-sex couples in the early 90s and then Vermont and Massachusetts later on. But those issues sort of kept the issue of same-sex marriage in the headlines. We went over the arguments for a couple of decades, for and against, and I just think the substance of the arguments wound up being very one-sided.
And you anticipated where I wanted to go with this and what you just said there a minute ago, but we'll get into some of the arguments that you make in your book. But first, could you just give us a thumbnail refresher course on the legal path of same-sex marriage?
Yeah. So the with respect to marriage in particular, I'll just start with Bowers versus Hardwick was the case in 1987 where the Supreme Court upheld criminal prohibitions on same-sex sexual relations. And that was a closely divided court. It was a 5-4 decision. And one thing that was very striking there in 1987 when the issue was not marriage equality but simply privacy rights for gay people having sex in the privacy of their homes was how weak the conservative arguments were upholding those criminal prohibitions. And even conservatives admitted that. The justice that wrote the opinion, Justice White, referred to biblical teachings and centuries of moral teaching, in effect just gestured towards the past and the fact that people had always thought that homosexuality was wrong. And Chief Justice Berger chimed in with similar quotations from Blackstone and so on and so forth. And so conservatives were kind of embarrassed by the quality of that opinion. And that helped to generate some argument. Then, as I say, shortly after that, kind of surprisingly, the Hawaii Supreme Court entertained the idea of same-sex marriage. At first, issued a kind of preliminary judgment finding that prohibitions on same-sex marriage were a form of sex discrimination because women were prevented from marrying women and men were prevented from marrying men. So it was under a kind of sex discrimination rubric that they upheld that. There was a big backlash in Hawaii. The state constitution was amended, and same-sex marriage did not come to Hawaii. But that energized the issue as a national issue because, of course, conservative groups worried that couples from anywhere in the country could go to Hawaii, get married, and then return to their states and very possibly have those marriages recognized in the rest of the country. So that was a huge issue. And then in the 1990s, there was a controversy in Colorado over Colorado's Amendment 2, which was part of the backlash that arose from the Hawaii decision. It basically was a state referendum that said that the local ordinances that protected gays against discrimination in housing and employment and elsewhere, it ruled them all unconstitutional. So it struck down all of those local protective ordinance for gays. And in that was the first decision in which, at the Supreme Court level, Anthony Kennedy wrote an opinion for the Supreme Court, basically starting by quoting Plessy versus Ferguson and invoking civil rights for African Americans and striking down that state constitutional provision that wiped out local protective ordinances. So that was very important in that respect. It was the first decision coming down from the Supreme Court sort of protecting gay and lesbian equality in an important way. And then as we went to the turn of the millennium, Vermont enacted a civil union statute, a domestic partnership statute. There was some pushback on that, for sure, a bit of a backlash. And then Massachusetts in 2003 became the first state to institute same-sex marriage. And that same year, Lawrence versus Texas overturned Bowers versus Hardwick, that earlier case that I mentioned, establishing privacy rights for gays. Anthony Kennedy's second big opinion protecting gay rights. And then running into 2014, 2015, first the Windsor U.S. versus Windsor case establishing marriage at the federal level, and then Obergefell establishing it as a national right in 2015 across the country as a matter of basic right. So that's the nutshell historical overview. And I hope I have my dates and case names right. So one of your listeners will call in if I've made a mistake there. I'm doing this without notes.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Stephen Macedo, a professor of politics at Princeton University and the author of Just Married, Same-Sex Couples, Monogamy, and the Future of Marriage. Well, I want to get into some of the arguments in your book now. Many advocates of marriage equality focus on the legal entitlements that are embedded in marriage that are more automatic and stronger than in civil unions as one of the important reasons for it, you know, making decisions for an incapacitated partner or assumptions about child custody, for instance. But you also write about the public but non-legal importance of being legally married, what it means for society, what it means for the couple. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's absolutely crucial, Grant. You know, in California, for example, I left out the controversy there and elsewhere when cases were going through the courts involving same-sex marriage rights, it was noted that civil unions in California, as they did in Vermont, provided gay and lesbian couples with all the same benefits, those visitation rights, powers of attorney, and so on and so forth. They bundled the specific benefits together under a separate rubric of domestic partnership or civil union. And the judge asked more than once, so you mean we're having this whole controversy, this litigation about the word marriage? And over and over, litigants said, including Kristen Perry in California, yes, because the symbolic meaning of marriage is much of what's at stake. Part of getting married is not just taking on these rights and obligations, which are very important, no question, but entering into a publicly legible form of commitment to build a life in common together with another person. And I have heard many people say, including same-sex couples who got married, some cases sort of reluctantly after it was legal because they had been together for so long and not been married. And they, well, what's the big deal? And I've heard them say it changed everything. To have that public recognition of your relationship and to make that commitment in public, it's very significant. And I think what I argue is that the law of marriage facilitates the ability of people to enter into a form of commitment that they want to enter into to build a life in common together. And the law of marriage makes that legible in the entire country so that people can get married and be married, not just in the eyes of their friends, their fellow church members or club members, but in the eyes of the whole society. That's what people want.
And you write about the concerns among some social and legal thinkers and observers about this slippery slope associated with marriage equality, that somehow it's going to lead to legalizing polygamy and otherwise undermining marriage itself. And some observers worry about the slippery slope and others invite it. So could you explain that slippery slope argument and the different reactions to it?
Absolutely. It's most prominent in the dissents, the dissenting opinions of Justice Scalia in all of those Supreme Court cases that I mentioned. I think it's there in Rome, or it's certainly there in Lawrence, and it's certainly there again in the Windsor and Obergefell cases. Right from the very beginning, he said, unless states and the national government are allowed to discriminate against gays simply on the basis of the convictions, the sentiments of the people, there'll be the slippery slope from same-sex rights of any kind to incest, bigamy, adultery, masturbation, he called. He had this list of things, and polygamy. Justice Roberts, in the Obergefell opinion, his dissent specifically mentions polygamy, which he said is closer to heterosexual marriage than same-sex marriage, and thinks that we're heading in that direction. So on the right, as all of the arguments fell away, I think, that were more substantial arguments against same-sex marriage, one thing they were left with was this sense of a slippery slope, that if we have it, there'll be no principled basis for stopping short of adult incest, polygamy, and so on and so forth. So on the right, that's been a very frequently heard argument. And then one of the things that got me interested in this book was, exactly as you say, I was surprised to see how many people on the left embrace the slope. in fact, almost all of it. I mean, there are very few philosophers, ethicists that argue for adult incest, but there are some. And it's actually thinking about why we should regard that as prohibited if they're not going to have children and so on, if they're adult siblings, say. It's a consensual relationship. It's worth thinking about, you know, what's wrong there. And I do have an argument about that very briefly in the book, and I've elaborated a bit more since.
There's a difference between having something legal and endorsing it as a practice, I suppose. Right.
Completely, though. Yeah. I think actually there's a ground for the criminal prohibition. Okay. Enforcement, I think, is a different matter. But in prospectively protecting children who would be made vulnerable by the relaxation of prohibitions against sexual relations in the family, I think that's a significant enough interest to maintain a general criminal prohibition. But in any case, polygamy has been another one that's been very big, where I think one of the things that's important here is that we really haven't thought about the arguments. You know, why has monogamy been such an important part of our culture in a way without our really thinking about it? So I wanted to look at not just the meaning of marriage as an institution, as we talked about, but whether after same-sex marriage, these other things could continue to be prohibited, the items on the slippery slope, as it were, and polygamy is the one I wind up focusing on.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Stephen Macedo. He's the Lawrence Rockefeller Professor of Politics at Princeton University and the author of Just Married: Same-Sex Couples, Monogamy, and the Future of Marriage. Just before the break, you mentioned polygamy. I want to come back to that. You argue that same-sex marriage actually strengthens monogamous marriage and therefore the institution of marriage itself as a special status. So explain that argument briefly if you can.
I will, Grant, and you got it exactly right. I appreciate the question. Yes. So, right. I'm arguing far from same-sex marriage being a step or a point on the slippery slope from marriage to polygamy. Quite the opposite is the case for the following reason. Polygamy, as known to human history, as known to human experience, is highly patriarchal. It is pretty much always a polygyny, one husband with multiple wives. Now, there are various reasons to explain that. Some of it's historical, patriarchy, the power of men. But moral psychology and evolutionary psychology also suggest that men tend to have a much greater interest in multiple partners, and also that male jealousy is much harder to control. So there may be reasons – I don't put too much emphasis on this, but there may be reasons embedded in our evolved psychology that help to explain this. But in any case, as known across human societies – throughout history and currently, the form of polygamy that's known as a social system uniformly pretty much has been this patriarchal form. And it is highly inegalitarian. It disadvantages lower status males in the marriage market, and lower status males who are unmarried tend to engage in much higher rates of violence and drug abuse and alcohol abuse and so on. And it deprives them, the way I argue it, of the fair opportunity to enter into the great good of family relations. So and most importantly, or equally importantly, everywhere in the world that women have become equal, monogamy rules. Everywhere in the world that women are becoming equal and polygamy exists, women see it as an obstacle to the realization of their equality. Women's health outcomes and children's health outcomes are worse in polygamous families because of conflict, in the home, and because fewer resources flow to each child taken individually. Wealthier, upper status males have an incentive to put their resources into finding additional wives rather than in their children. So individual children do worse under polygamy. So, you know, interestingly, we don't know the exact historical origins of monogamy, but it seems to be in ancient Greece before the historical period. And the story that's told from that point of view is that monogamy helped the Greek city-states become more cooperative within the Greek city-states. It was more inclusive of all the males as full participants, not quite full participants, but in any case, more egalitarian, less conflictual. And so monogamy succeeded as part of a successful social structure, was adopted by the Roman Empire, was later picked up by Christianity, and spread with the influence of Rome first and then Christianity. So the origins are Western but not Christian. But monogamy has been adopted as part of the modernizing project by, well, Kemal Ataturk in Turkey, India in its post-independence constitution except for Muslims. Mao Zedong adopted it in China in 49-51 as part of what he called state feminism. and so as countries have modernized and adopted more equal social relationships, monogamy has become the rule. And the final way in which same-sex marriage goes along with more egalitarian relationships is that spousal roles in same-sex marriages tend to be more equal. So this is one reason why feminists have tended to strongly support same-sex marriage. I think it's one reason why some traditionalists have been against it, because they see the traditional family as going along with separate roles for husband and wife. The husband is the breadwinner. Often the husband is the decider. So same-sex marriage is an egalitarian form of marriage, and it seems to me it imprints equal liberty even more deeply into the DNA of married life, you could say.
If you just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Princeton professor Stephen Macedo. I want to shift now to a related but different topic that's in the news right now. There's an active discussion currently going on regarding the rights of transgendered persons, access to bathrooms, to sports teams, other things. Does your work, do you think, provide any insight into those debates that you'd want to share?
Yeah, I don't talk about that directly because it's sort of come up more recently. Mm-hmm. And it's not, I mean, the book is really about marriage in particular. So this hasn't figured so much there, and I haven't worked a lot on it. But it is interesting that as we become a more tolerant society, I think we've learned more about human sexuality. And I think it's always been the case that some people experience, you know, their gender identity of birth as something that's not suited to them. I mean, there can be biological reasons for that, and certainly there seem to be deep-seated psychological reasons. So I think it's good that we are understanding that human beings represent a more diverse range of types than simple male and female. And I think it's great that people are feeling freer to, you know, express their true feelings, and that we're recognizing that and attempting to help them lead the lives that they feel happy with. So this is the kind of thing that I think society is going to accept more and more. It's just hard to see what the argument is on the other side, you know, we should help people to feel happy and lead happy, productive lives, you know, given the way that they feel that they are. So I think we're learning more about this, and I actually think this is another issue where the progress will be speedy.
And on that note, I'm also curious to know, in the process of doing this work and your reflections more generally, do you have any sense or hunches about what some of the future frontiers might be for either the institution of marriage itself, which your book talks a lot about, or the rights of minority sexual identity groups?
Yeah, nice question. I'll say a couple things about marriage first, because that's the one I've thought most about. I think one thing that is striking is that among young people, people in their 20s, I think our college students, there seems to be less of a belief in marriage, less of a commitment to marriage. Now, I think that's partly it's age. People are marrying later in life, especially college students, college educated. I'm not sure that's a good thing. One thing we do see is a huge class divide with respect to marriage. It's become the case that marriage is weakest among those with only high school degrees or high school dropouts, partly because they have more traditional attitudes towards the husband-wife role. They want the husband to be the breadwinner to a greater extent, and the decline of factory jobs and good jobs for people with lower levels of education have dried up. So marriage is much less stable among the less educated, and that's difficult for children. So this is widening the class divide. If you look at college graduates on the other side, people getting married, both of whom have college degrees, they're marrying later in life. They're finishing their college degrees, finishing graduate degrees sometimes. They're having sex before marriage, but they're not having children before marriage. They're postponing having children till after they're married. And those marriages are much more egalitarian than in the past, not fully egalitarian. Husbands still don't do the dishes as much as they as much as their wives do. But it's more egalitarian. They do more child care than in the past. Those children of those college educated are doing extremely well. They're sort of hyper parents, the helicopter parents that take their children everywhere and give them to. So there is a widening class gap that Robert Putnam has written about and others associated with this education and income gap in people's tendency to have children in marriage. And children do better when they have two parents. It's partly a resource thing, but it's also time, attention, emotional support, and so on. So it's not just children. I think we should give more support to all parents, not just married parents. But that's one thing, I think, the widening class divide. And then the other thing that's connected with the book is this whole theme of polyamory, which people talk about, the possibility of throuples and moresomes, as it's called. Are people going to develop more egalitarian forms of plural relationship? There's a lot of blogging on this. There's not a single empirical study. I'm sort of skeptical about it. It seems to me that two works for the kind of commitment that marriage is. It's hard enough to share a life with one person. Can you imagine the conflicts involved in the case of the mischiefs of faction gone wild, Madisonian issues. But there are a lot of, again, younger people who think that polyamory will have a future. And I guess we'll see.
And a super quick question at the end. I want to compliment you on your clever title, Just Married. I was wondering, is that a double meaning or a triple meaning? Because I can come up with three in my head.
Tell me what the three are, and I should tell you my editor at Princeton University Press, Rob Tempio, came up with it. So he'll appreciate that. Go ahead.
Only married, yeah. Recently married, and fairly married.
You're absolutely correct. There may be a fourth.
That was Stephen Macedo. His book is titled Just Married, Same-Sex Couples, Monogamy, and the Future of Marriage. Steve, thanks so much for talking with me.
I've enjoyed it a lot.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.